Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza, the Canary's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Each week, we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days. Today, it's U-turns, smears, and other nonsense. We'll be looking at Theresa May's latest figures on unemployment, Liam Fox's chlorinated chicken scandal, and the student debt smear campaign whipped up by the Conservative Party and the Conservative media. I'll be joined by UK editor Bec Sumner, global editor Ed Sykes, and Canary writer Sophia Akram. Welcome, team.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, so let's start with some nonsense. Due to Brexit, the UK is heading into a new trade deal with the United States and its wonderful president, the tangerine tycoon Donald Trump. And this may create some major problems in food production and preparation. So, Bex, why is everyone freaking out about chlorinated chickens?
Well, yeah, so basically Liam Fox, our international trade secretary, he's been in the US wooing them for post-Brexit trade deals. Mm-hmm. And it's all gone as catastrophically as you might imagine. basically, he wants to water down food safety rules and regulation as a whole,
yeah,
to try and get a free trade deal with the US. So what this effectively means is that shrinking the role of UK, you know, the British state, and handing power over to foreign corporations, really. The story has been that Britain could be forced to import chlorinated chicken, lactic acid sprayed pork, hormone grown beef, that kind of thing.
So these were all basically regulations prepared sort of in the EU and enforced by UK law, mostly in kind of the late 90s. That were intended to make our production of food safer, to protect the public health, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's banned. Washing chicken, you know, chlorinated chicken is banned in the EU. Basically, what it is chicken carcasses are washed in water containing chlorine dioxide to kill stuff like E. coli and Salmonella after they've been killed. The US allows it. You know, the idea, there's lots of good reasons for banning it. So, the EU argues that allowing that allows abattoirs to have really slack standards and just wash off all the disgusting stuff, right, and the dangerous stuff at the end. It also has implications for animal welfare when they're alive, you know, the standards in the abattoir and the standards on farms, and whether that can just all be dealt with when it's carcass.
Yeah.
There's safety question. The European Food Safety Authority has questioned whether it's a potential health concern for children, depending on quantity. Others have suggested that compounds used for washing chickens might be carcinogen. You know, carcinogenic. So there's all sorts of issues from animal welfare, from food safety, from, you know, public health. It covers the whole lot. I should say that free market proponents absolutely love chlorinated chicken. They seem to think it's brilliant. The Adam Smith Institute has been pumping out propaganda in its favour this week and stuff. Liam Fox was approached at a press conference and asked what he thought about it. And he didn't, you know, he basically accused journalists of being obsessed over this issue. Said it's just
The British media are obsessed with chlorine washed chickens. a detail of the very end stage of one sector of a potential free trade agreement. I say no more than that.
But it's actually, it might sound like a tiny issue to some other people as well, but it's actually fundamental to Brexit. It's exactly the kind of detail that sums up everything that's dangerous about the way the Tories are going about Brexit.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Barry Gardiner responded by saying Liam Fox is showing that he's ready to abandon British poultry farmers in favour of cheap US imports that don't meet our sanitary or animal welfare standards.
Yeah.
And the question is what kind of country you want to live in. And, you know, Liam Fox, anyway, has exposed that the Tories want it, you know, to be a country where we import cheap meat with low welfare standards, putting British farmers out of work, you know, potentially, according to some, putting public health at some risk. And it's catastrophic. It's also, you know, what's happened is that it's EU, senior EU officials have been laughing at us this week.
Yeah.
Or specifically at Liam Fox, saying his suggestion that we can do this and it'll all be fine is laughable, because it just completely risks all future trade between the UK and EU in terms of food. You know, the EU has said as a result of chlorinated chicken and that kind of issue, Ireland may need to have a hard border.
It's an absolute nightmare. I mean, the other side of this as well is beyond the chlorinated chickens. I mean, you touched on, you know, growth hormones in beef, and you know, part of the issue is you've got the, you know, the growth kind of production involves antibiotic use. And one of the biggest issues facing public health right now is resistance to antibiotics, is antimicrobial resistance. You know, there are scientists all over the world, all over the EU, everywhere right now, you know, whose number one priority and number one fear is the growing resistance to antibiotics. You know, we're seeing, you know, diseases, infectious diseases that we have long been cured, you know, by antibiotics now becoming resistant. That is a public health crisis in the waiting that scientists are working very, very hard to find a solution to before it emerges as a public health crisis. And, you know, this policy, I mean, you know, if we go down this route with the US in this trade deal, you know, it is in large part going to disrupt and delay progress in that direction. So you know, people listening at home, we're not just talking about maybe the odd salmonella breakout that we might endure. You know, we're talking about threatening the fight against antimicrobial resistance, which, believe me, everyone at home needs to care about quite profoundly, because our lives could depend on it at some point.
Exactly. If it goes ahead, we're basically exporting a load of animal welfare problems.
Yeah.
And we're importing a load of public health problems. It's not a great idea.
Absolutely. I mean, to be honest, I'm getting to the point where I'm starting to feel like Liam Fox might be the most dangerous man in this government, and he's kind of gone under the radar a little bit. But just to remind our listeners, Liam Fox was a defence secretary in the coalition government. He resigned in disgrace in 2011. And that's not a side issue. It's actually incredibly pertinent to this issue that we're discussing today, you know, because what he resigned for, in essence, was, I mean, what he's almost been rehired to do now, isn't it? You know, yeah. it was inviting lobbyists, US lobbyists, corporate lobbyists into the heart of UK government in order to get rid of what he would describe as red tape. And what you and I would probably describe as justified regulations to protect public health.
Exactly. I mean, you've got to ask whose interests he's working in. I mean, even Michael Gove has spoken out against this now. So, you know, senior Tories are in chaos, as usual, about it. And Theresa May said not much at all. She hasn't ruled it in or out. So, it's exposed the split again at the top of the Tories. And yeah, but like you say, yeah, Liam Fox is not the person we want to be conducting international trade deals, supposedly on behalf of the British public.
Absolutely. I mean, what you would hope we could be able to say in this situation is we fear that the US will attempt to leverage, you know, Britain's economic vulnerability in the Brexit kind of era in order to push for these things. But, you know, we have representatives at that negotiating table who are, you know, personally and professionally committed to upholding these standards, which have kept the British public health certainly in a much finer state than the US public health. We don't have that, do we, Bex?
No, we have someone going, way, race to the bottom.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't charge there fast enough. I mean, this, you know, Liam Fox is ideologically committed to repealing these regulations. You know, he said it countless times. This is not something that's a suspicion. It's something he wears as a badge of honour, you know, his political ideology. I mean, he set up the charity Atlantic Bridge, which is, you know, essentially a kind of, almost neoconservative, network, if for want of a better word, bankrolled by ALEC, which is a leading kind of conservative lobby group in the States. Supported and in partnership with the Tea Party, you know, the Koch brothers. It's just, I mean, it's really deep and insidious, and it really should be concerning to us all that, you know, right now, you know, Liam Fox was in Washington this week, starting to negotiate this trade deal. And I think really, you know, we will at the Canary be going through the small print of this very closely, because I think once this I think the state of this US trade deal is going to, I think, be fairly emblematic of what we can expect Tory Brexit to look like, which again could pressure us to maybe push for an ousting of the Conservatives before they get anywhere near Brexit. Is there anything else you wanted to add on that, Bex?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's also quite terrifying, the difference between, you know, the Tories blustering, oh yeah, it's all going to be fine, and the actual reality when you come to face to face with a detail like this. So Liam Fox, I think it was just last week, said, you know, a post-Brexit free trade deal with the EU should be the, quote, easiest in human history, right? So this one issue of chlorinated chicken has got the, you know, EU politicians saying, if you do that, you know, all your trade, all your agricultural trade with the EU will be at risk.
Yeah, well, they're not going to be exactly. Importing chlorinated chickens, and
exactly, they don't want Britain to be importing, you know, exporting meat to the EU when it includes stuff like chlorinated chicken and stuff.
Yeah.
So, and that's one issue relating to food. There's around 4,500 EU regulations covering food, farming, and environmental standards.
Right.
Just in DEFRA's remit. And the whole body of EU law is around, you know, estimated, nobody quite knows, but it's estimated to be around 80,000 items.
Oh.
All of these are going to raise issues that have to be negotiated and thought about and abolished or incorporated. And yeah, and there's, you know, Liam Fox going, oh no, it's going to be the easiest deal in human history.
Well, you know, bacteria don't respect borders, right?
Exactly.
So, oh no, we won't cross the channel. So this is Liam Fox's approach when it comes to regulations protecting something as serious and as universal as public health. What do you think his approach is going to be on jobs and employment and trade law?
Exactly.
You know?
Really quite frightening. Really frightening.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that, Bex.
Pleasure.
And as always, you can... look at the small print next to the podcast and you will be able to link to the stories that we're discussing today, so you can read about them in a little more detail. And the next story stays with nonsense, the government's latest jobs figures. Sophia, can you tell us what your story on the jobs figures was all about? You know, who's saying what and why is this an issue that our listeners need to care about?
Yeah, sure. So this was about the figures for unemployment that came out in May. So they announced a kind of unprecedented unemployment rate of 4.5%, which is the lowest that unemployment has ever been in Britain since 1975. So
that sounds like a great thing, right?
It does sound like a great thing. Which is why people should probably be a little bit wary, because obviously things aren't great at the moment, which is what the story was about. So Business Insider is kind of like a business news and market analysis news outlet. And they had like a little interesting report about why we should be a bit wary, because the unemployment rate is so low that things should be really great right now.
Yeah.
Apparently, like economic theory basically says that we're always going to have some sort of unemployment out there. So it's never going to be zero. It's all, like, if it's between 5 and 8%, that means things are great.
Okay.
That actually means that it's a job seekers market. So in theory, wages should go up. You know, we should have low inflation.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously that's not really the case. It's a case that more and more people are using food banks. We've got precarious employment terms out there.
Mm-hmm.
So what Business Insider have said is basically, you know, if you take into account all those people on, you know, part-time work that want to be in full-time work, people who are classed as economically inactive when really they are looking for work, the figure's more like 25%, which is...
Whoa.
And huge.
That's massive.
Yeah, exactly.
So they've got the government saying, hey, guys, great news. We've got, you know, the highest employment, or at least the lowest unemployment figures we've seen, you know, for decades. And what Business Insider is saying is actually these figures don't correlate to reality by some serious degree.
Yeah, precisely. And that's all about the way they put it is that it's so low now, you have to actually question the definition. Right. So the way that we class unemployment is, I mean, it sounds quite sensible. It's people without a job who are actively seeking work, mm-hmm. Who've been actively seeking work in the past 4 weeks.
Right.
Available to start work right now and within the next 2 weeks. But I think that's the main problem with the definition, really, is because it kind of classes out a whole bunch of people. Like, there are a lot of people, I don't know if you've ever been unemployed, like I've been unemployed before. Yeah. And there are times when, you know, you get so discouraged by the job market, you take a little break.
Yeah.
If that break goes beyond 6 weeks, you know, you're classed as economically inactive, not unemployed.
Right. So that whole sea of people are not represented in these figures at all.
No, exactly. Same if you're a stay-at-home mum. Mm-hmm. You may have, you know, stayed at home for a while and you're ready to go back out there while you're looking for work. You're still not classed as unemployed. You're classed as economically inactive.
And do we know what that... I mean, how big is that population? Do we know? Are there estimates?
Well, Business Insider have said if you take into account that type of population, that makes it as high as 25%. In the past, people have estimated something a little bit more modest, like 12%. Mm-hmm. Other people have said it's about 1 million more in terms of people than the government has said. So, I mean, it's been variable.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, I think we can safely say that things aren't great. Unemployment probably isn't that low.
And also, I mean, I think you point to something actually quite disturbing about this as well, which is Theresa May's whole mantra. You know, I've lost count of the times that she said, you know, work is the route out of poverty. You know, and this whole ideology, the stated ideology of the Conservatives around their, you know, their cuts to the welfare state, you know, their fairly brutal reassessment policies, like, you know, the work capability assessments and all of those things that have hit sick and disabled people and particularly very hard, has all been predicated on this view that, you know, there are these people that wanted to work and they haven't been able to work. They've been trapped in the welfare system and now we've helped them all into jobs and that's their route out of poverty. And what this report is saying and countless other reports that we've seen around, you know, the increased use of food banks, you know, 1.2 million food parcels handed out in the last year. You know, the massive rise in child poverty, I mean, that's spiked. You know, everywhere you look, there are signs that people are absolutely not getting, you know, out of poverty. Quite the opposite is happening, is that a lot of people who were, you know, previously maybe precarious have now slidden into poverty. I mean, doesn't this basically undermine their whole...
Yeah, exactly. And I think anecdotally, and also some reports have sort of mentioned the new universal credit system and sanctions that take place because, you know, under the new system, and what used to happen before, obviously, is like sanctions would put pressure on people who are seeking work to, like, you know, actually take something that they may not be comfortable taking. So people have said now they're taking jobs with precarious terms of employment, such as 0 hours contracts. Mm. And that's something else. Like, if you're working 1 hour a week, you're virtually unemployed.
Yeah.
But, you know, according to the government, they're not. They're employed. Things are great.
Oh, that's just outrageous. Is there anything more that we need to learn about that before we move on, Sophia?
I think also important to note is that, as well as unemployment, you know, being that high, it's wages as well. So not just last year, I think a report came out by the Trade Union Congress and it said that actually the UK have had a 10.4% drop in real wages.
Yeah, I remember the report.
Yeah, it makes it the worst in Europe after Greece.
Mm.
So, you know, it's not just a case of unemployment, you know, being quite high. It's a case that our wages are going down.
Absolutely. And I think that was, again, another thing that points to the idea that this economic recovery that the government keeps talking about, you know, it isn't happening for the majority of people, but it really is happening for the wealthiest people. So at that same time period that the Trade Union Congress noted that, you know, more than 10% drop in wages, you know, for the majority of people, executive pay actually went up by 10%.
Right, yeah.
So,
yeah,
exactly. You know, it's almost like, a transfer of wealth upwards, exactly. You know, quite starkly when you look at it like that. And I think at the same time as well, you've got, I think in 2010, the Sunday Times Rich List. So this is Britain's 1,000 richest people had a combined wealth of, I think, around £380 billion. That's almost doubled in the last 7 years.
Right.
You know, so as you say, you know, we're not only talking about the issue of employment at all, you know, on its own, it's actually what that quality of employment is and actually what's happening to, you know, the terms and conditions of the majority of people, you know, versus the terms and conditions of billionaires and corporate executives. It's a scandal. Thank you so much for taking us through that, Sophia.
No worries. It
really is one of the central issues that we need to be discussing at the moment, because it is a fiction. You know, it's an issue that affects every person of working age and the people who depend on them. So thank you for that. It was really clear.
Hi, it's Nancy here. I just wanted to let you know the result of last week's Twitter poll. We asked you, which day of the week would you prefer Canary Pod to be published? Most people didn't mind, and of those who did, there was a slight preference for Friday. So that's what we're going to aim for in the future. Please do keep in touch. You can get us on Twitter at CanaryPod or email podcast@thecanary.co. And we'd really love to hear from you and have your feedback about how you're enjoying the podcast. Thanks. Bye-bye.
And now we're going to wrap up. We've covered a lot of nonsense today. We're going to actually finish with a quite breathtaking story about U-turns and smears. Ed, goodness gracious, where do we start? Can you talk us through, let's begin with the student debt smear campaign and kind of chart the course of this smear and then explain the motives behind it?
Yeah, well, this is a story that is a great example of how messed up Britain's corporate media is today.
Yeah.
It really is. The Tories and their cheerleaders in the corporate media have been arguing that Corbyn's Labour Party has made a U-turn on its policy regarding university tuition fees. They say it promised to cancel all historic student debt before the election and is now abandoning that promise. The problem is, that's fake news. But figures from Theresa May to Nigel Farage have all jumped on the bandwagon regardless. And even Vince Cable, the new leader of the Lib Dems, a party so tainted and toxic because of its abandonment of previous promises on tuition fees, has dared to call on Corbyn to apologise for the imaginary U-turn on a non-existent promise.
Can we just listen to what Jeremy Corbyn actually said in the interview with the NME?
That's fundamentally the principle behind it. Yes, there is a problem of those that currently have a massive debt. And I'm looking at ways that we could reduce that, ameliorate that, lengthen the period of paying it off, or some other means of reducing that debt burden. I don't have the simple answer for it at this stage. I don't think anybody would expect me to, because this election was called unexpected. We had 2 weeks to prepare all of this. But I'm very well aware of that problem, and I don't see why those that had the historically misfortune to be at university during the 9,000 period should be burdened excessively compared to those that went before or those that come after. So I will deal with it.
Why is it important?
Yeah, I got to be honest. That tweet from Vince Cable just took my breath away. It was outrageous.
Yeah. How could he dare to do that?
Yeah, well, like, and all the pundits as well really got behind this story. I mean, there were notable exceptions. James O'Brien at LBC was one of the few journalists who stood out as actually just saying this is complete nonsense. You know, he kind of went through, I think he spent 3 hours on his show the other day asking people to ring in, asking young people to ring in if they felt they'd been betrayed. Zero. He got zero response.
Well, for me personally, student debt made me question whether going to university was worth it, both while I was there and ever since. And it's really sad when anyone questions the value of education, because it's priceless and incredibly valuable for our whole society. And it pushes us to reach our full potential and fuels the innovation that we need to improve our collective future. That's why it should be truly accessible for everyone of all ages and abilities. And figures from all parties, the Tories, the New Labour figures, Lib Dems, all let us down on that.
I don't think you're alone in feeling that.
No. Yeah, I mean, the truth is that Labour's manifesto is quite clear, really. It promised to abolish university tuition fees, mm-hmm. a pledge it's sticking to, but included absolutely no mention of wiping out existing student debt.
Absolutely.
So if Labour had won, students starting in September mm-hmm. would not have paid tuition fees.
Yeah.
The promise was costed and would have been funded by increasing taxes on the highest earners, mm-hmm. but there was absolutely no pledge regarding graduates who'd already paid the fees and have an average debt today of around £50,000. So that was not included at all.
It wasn't in the manifesto, it wasn't in the campaign leaflets, it wasn't on a single poster, and Jeremy Corbyn never said it.
Exactly, yeah. And as we heard in the quote from the NME interview, his critics basically took his words out of context. They picked apart they thought would help the smear and ignored the rest. But he was very, very clear that he had an ambition to help out former students with their existing debt and said he'd be looking into it.
Yep.
But he made absolutely no promise to wipe it out in that interview.
Absolutely. I think what most of us were excited about the interview, I think many of us said Labour could wipe out historic student debt. I mean, it wasn't that they mm-hmm. would. It wasn't that it was a manifesto pledge or a promise, but saying at least there's someone there who's actually saying we need to do something about this historic debt. We don't know what we're going to do about it yet because, you know, it needs to be costed and we need to work it out. But in principle, you know, he was sympathetic to the concerns of those who were, you know, 50 grand in debt, you know, for the sake mm-hmm. of their education.
But he didn't mention wiping out even.
He didn't.
He just said, I'm looking at ways that we can reduce that, ameliorate it, lengthen the period of paying it off, or some other means of reducing that debt burden. He wasn't talking about getting rid of it completely. It was talking about different ways in which students, former students with existing debt could be helped.
And that's a huge distinction, right? Because that, you know, we had the Liberal Democrats in 2010. This was a central platform plank of their manifesto, was that they were going to scrap tuition fees. You know, they signed the pledge related to tuition fees, at least not increasing them. The preference to wipe them out. You know, there's photos that you can go and see on the internet of Nick Clegg standing next to Julian Huppert, who incidentally did keep his promise. He was one of the 21 rebel Liberal Democrat MPs who fought against the increase of tuition fees. It's important to note. Vince Cable, the new leader, broke that promise. He voted in favour of raising tuition fees. So having gained power, you know, largely because of a student and youth vote, on the basis that they would at the least halt the increase of tuition fees, if not scrap them altogether, Vince Cable, Nick Clegg and other leading Liberal Democrats came into office and tripled them. Tripled them. And in fact, the Conservative Party, literally within the last few weeks, gave universities the power to raise tuition fees every year. So, I mean, what's the point of this smear ad? Because what it looks like to me is the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats and a Conservative media, all of whom are in favour of tuition fees and see nothing wrong at all with student debt and have no plans at all to deal with it or alleviate it in any way, are saying to young people, the best they've got is Jeremy Corbyn is, what, just as bad as us? Is that the kind of best platform that Conservatives have to run on now?
To be honest, it's not even that. It's basically Jeremy Corbyn's only a little bit better than us. That's what I'm saying. It's not even saying that he's the same as us. He's saying, yeah, he's only a little bit better than us.
It's
ridiculous.
It's just...
But they've been going into absolute overdrive to push this smear, calling it a humiliation for Corbyn. But in reality, it's a humiliation for them. It's classic diversion tactics from both the Tories and the media cheerleaders. And as you said, James O'Brien was talking about this, and he talked about the absolute hypocrisy they've been showing by going after Corbyn and essentially ignoring, and I quote, the Conservative Party's abandonment of pretty much everything in their manifesto. And as he stressed, this is a sign of just how bonkers British media has become. Diversion tactics, misinformation, double standards, protecting the powerful rather than holding them to account.
Yeah.
And that's the environment we're facing today. And this smear is just another example of that.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's how bad this smear was, is that not only did it, I mean, firstly, it was published in places that young people don't even access their news from. So it was kind of led by the Evening Standard and the Daily Mail. And these are newspapers whose average reader age are both over 50. So I think the Daily Mail is 58. I can't remember the figure for the Evening Standard off the top of my head. So they're publishing things that Jeremy Corbyn never said in outlets that the young people don't ever read. And unfortunately, that meant that by the time the smear was, you know, the place, basically the first place that young people were reading about this smear campaign was from their sources. So it was from social media and from new media. And of course this, you know, and it might be an argument for the Conservatives to say, you know, the left has shot itself in the foot because, you know, we've created this story and now they're taking it to the young people. But that is so not how this went. It really didn't go that way.
It
was so nakedly, I mean, it was so provably false and so nakedly cynical that it just has ended up becoming kind of emblematic of everything wrong with the Conservative Party and their pundits and their press. So, Ed, do you want to talk a little bit about what the reaction was from young people and kind of those outside the Conservative media?
Yeah, in spite of the best efforts of all the anti-Corbyn media outlets, hardly anyone in Britain actually believed the smear. Young people were even less likely to believe it, according to one YouGov poll this week. In fact, people have been sharing across social media the full NME video, which is probably the best way to discredit the smear, with the people smearing Corbyn on social media.
Yeah.
So they can see actually the whole context of what he said and the exact words. The smear is also being called out for what it is, essentially. Fake news or blatant propaganda, Tory propaganda.
Absolutely. I saw, wasn't there a brilliant video that Momentum put out that I actually think is possibly the best rebuttal video that I've ever seen. In fact, it's worth playing it. I think we should just play it because you don't have to see it. It's the words that work. So let's just have a quick listen to that. It's only 71 seconds and it is, it's eviscerating. Here we go.
You know how Labour promised to clear everyone's student debt? Well, why didn't we make a big deal about that before the election? That would have been a game changer.
Labour didn't promise to clear anyone's student debt.
So what did Labour promise?
Labour promised to abolish tuition fees starting this September.
And that's still the case?
Yeah.
So why are the Tories saying Labour promised to clear everyone's current student debt?
Because Corbyn gave an interview to the NME where he said he'd look into ways to reduce current student debt, but clearly said that he didn't have a simple answer for that at that stage.
So is that why we didn't mention it in any of our press releases, posters, leaflets, media appearances, campaign rallies or social media? Because it wasn't actually Labour policy?
That's correct.
Huh. That's a relief. I thought I'd missed something. Just remind me, it was the Tories who tripled student fees, wasn't it?
It was indeed.
And they are planning to raise them further?
Yep.
They really are full of crap, aren't they?
Yep, the Tories are full of crap.
Okay, so can I just say that line about they really are full of crap, aren't they? How cool is that?
That's fantastic.
Completely true as well, completely true.
I think Mark Steele wrote a brilliant comment piece a couple of years back about this kind of pay-as-you-go welfare state that the Conservatives were trying to build. So it's like everything is about, I pay this, I get this. It's all transactional, like this direct one-to-one transaction, and no vision at all to see that that's not how welfare states work. It's about collective ambitions. Mm. It's about, you know, you might benefit, you might not benefit, say you privately educate your children, fantastic, you're not going to benefit from paying for the education system. But you know what? The doctor that cures your cancer did. You know, and there's this whole kind of, you create an ecosystem of mutual benefit. Mm. And that's why we pay into it. And I think, you know, from tuition fees to welfare cuts, you know, they're violating that principle over and over again. And as you say, turning university into something that you're thinking about in terms of direct financial reward or direct financial, you know, punishment, rather than this extraordinary opportunity to learn, expand your horizons, meet new people, develop your own humanity and intelligence and critical thinking. Totally right, Ed. It's a depressing version of university that they've created.
Yeah, it's an investment in us all if we actually have it accessible to everyone. It's an investment in society, in our future.
Absolutely.
In fact, the Tories are actually attracting attention onto themselves with this.
Yeah, and the worst elements of their most vulnerable flanks, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because if anyone's been U-turning, it's been Theresa May's Tories. There have been at least 10 such reversals just since the general election was called. And at the same time, they're also attracting attention, like you said, to the fact that they don't have any policies on student debt.
Absolutely. That
they wouldn't do anything themselves. So, and like you said, they actually voted to allow universities to increase tuition fees every year. So essentially, it's willfully reminding young people that they have nothing to offer them.
Oh, God. I think you make a good point there. And that is around, because I think for a lot of us, it was we understood what this smear campaign was. And, you know, we were asking ourselves in the newsroom, and I'd seen people saying it on social media, which is, what don't they want us looking at that they've mm-hmm. launched this smear campaign? Because it's a really bad one, but they're clearly putting a lot of effort into it. So why are they driving our attention in this direction? You know, what is happening in the world of conservative policy that they need us to be not looking at them right now? And I thought your piece was excellent, actually, Ed, which was actually, you know, I think, what was the headline again?
By creating one fake U-turn, the Tories are trying to hide 10 real ones.
Exactly, yeah.
And it was true. It was true.
Just, I mean, sums it up.
Oh, God. I mean, what can you guys...
It really is just diversion tactics from them. It really is.
I really...
They want to put all the attention over on Corbyn so yeah. that the media is not focusing on the disastrous election that they've just had, the disastrous and horrific deal that he's just done with the DUP, mm-hmm. all of these things, and take attention away from how useless they are with the Brexit negotiations, which yeah. are just starting. All of these things, they just want to distract us.
So I don't want to put you on the spot, Ed, but briefly, what are the 10 U-turns that they've made since the general election that they're really hoping to bury under this fake U-turn?
Okay. Fortunately, I've got the list here.
Yay!
the pensions triple lock, which they've made a couple of U-turns on.
Right.
Winter fuel payments, which they've also made a couple of U-turns on. Mm-hmm. The dementia tax, which has disappeared. Their methods on where to start Brexit negotiations. The energy price cap, which, again, has disappeared.
Oh, that's gone now, is it? The energy price cap?
It's nowhere to be seen,
oh,
really.
God. It was like the one progressive thing in that entire manifesto.
Yeah, yeah. There's certainly nothing apparent in the Queen's speech on that.
Right.
And the public sector pay cap, which wasn't exactly a pledge, but they did flip-flop several times in the same day.
Yeah.
And then before passing it through and then cheering when it got passed, which was so shocking.
It's sickening. And worse was the excuse. I remember when we were publishing, you know, Tory MPs are cheering while voting through a pay cut for nurses and police officers. Mm-hmm. And literally the best that the best comeback that ever came from the right on that was, hey, they're not applauding the pay cut. They're applauding because it's the first piece of legislation they've got through as the new government against Corbyn. I mean,
yeah.
What does that...
Shameful. You know?
Yeah. Sorry, Ed, carry on.
They came up with so many pathetic excuses to justify their cheering on that one. It was just, yeah, shameful.
And the other couple were on free school lunches, the scrapping of free school lunches, and abortions for Northern Irish women.
Right. And that, no doubt, is going to be, these are issues that are going to grow ever more significant, no doubt, over the course of this parliament, for however long this bizarre coalition with the DUP lasts, right?
Yeah, I would say that the two big ones on the public sector pay cap and the energy price cap, both really gargantuan issues.
Yeah.
But where the Tories are absolutely useless and they haven't done anything for us on those issues and probably won't.
Where are the ideas in conservatism right now? I don't see where the big ideas are. I don't see anything coming out of the party right now that is even vaguely meritocratic, that is even vaguely nodding in the direction of a progressive approach to anything. Am I alone? Have I missed something?
No. Simple answer. No, I don't think you've missed anything. I haven't seen a single thing either.
No, it just feels like, you remember on Newsnight and we were just saying, you know, it's like a zombie government clinging onto power with its cold, dead hands. It just feels like the only point of conservative in government right now is to stay in government, you know, and just cling.
To survive the next month, the next year.
Yeah. I don't get any energy from them. Even the kind of pundits and the, you know, even if you go and look at Conservative Home or The Spectator and actually kind of look at, you know, what are they talking about? What are their energy levels like? It's just like, it's really just depressing, you know, that it's kind of, there doesn't seem to be any kind of unifying theory there about, you know, what direction conservatism is going in, you know, how conservatism in the 21st century is going to be a positive force, you know, for people and planet. There's just kind of, it just feels like the whole energy has shifted to progressive politics right now. You know, you go and look at what's happening in new media, look at what's happening, you know, even down in your local, you know, Labour meeting or your Green Party meeting. It seems like all the energy is there. You know, all of the kind of passion, all of the ideas are there right now. It's bizarre. It's such a turnaround for us. I mean, you've been writing, you know, for maybe the last 10 years, you know, kind of there's been a noticeable shift, you know, in confidence and in energy.
Yeah, it's a really exciting time for progressives, I think. It's kind of, you know, progressive ideas have entered the mainstream parties.
Yeah.
Finally, after a long break. Yeah, it's there's a lot of energy around.
Like you say, Kerry-Ann, it's the establishment politics just trying to cling on to power. That's their only real policy, trying to cling on to power. Yeah. And that's the same from the Conservatives to the new Labour figures to the Lib Dems. They've all, coming back to education, they've all let us down regarding education.
Yeah.
But because Corbyn's offering something different, that's why the establishment, which sees education as just another money-making scheme, is attacking him now. Not just on that, I mean, on a whole host of issues, he's offering something different, and that's why establishment politicians are shitting it. Can't think of another way of saying that.
I think that's about right. I think, you know, another way of putting it, I think, is, you know, the establishment isn't afraid of Jeremy Corbyn, they're afraid of you. You know, they're afraid of you listening right now. They're afraid of your dreams. Yep. They're afraid of you having access to the power and the privilege that they've enjoyed exclusively for so long. And I'm really happy that perhaps, potentially in our lifetime, we might actually start moving things quite quickly in the opposite direction. That's certainly what we're working for. So before we go, guys, I'm conscious that people might be listening to the stories that we've covered today and be really wanting to do something about it, to get involved in some way that they can. So can we start with Bex? What can people do about the issue with the trade deal with the US?
Well, I mean, I think probably the best thing best thing to do is be able to write to your MP to express your concern about the post-Brexit US trade deal. Just be vocal about the kind of country you want to live in and what you will and won't accept.
Brilliant. That's a really good point. I know for a lot of people, you know, we've become quite cynical about this stuff. But the fact is, you know, don't let our own cynicism silence us. You know, it is on all of us to make sure we pressure those MPs all the way through this process, particularly the ones that we think won't listen, because they're the ones that need the most pressure. So thanks for that, Bex. That's a really good tip. So that's what we can do about the trade deal. We've also got the job stuff.
Well, I think, I mean, with a lot of this stuff, it's actually one of the most important things people can do is just have conversations with other people.
Good point.
And so, you know, if you're sat in the pub and someone's got the Daily Mail open and it says, you know, unemployment's fallen to 4.whatever%, and they're going, oh, yeah, you know, Theresa May, brilliant, Conservative Party, brilliant, look what they've done. And then to say, well, you know, actually, if you look at the figures in this different way, the number comes out quite different.
Yeah, that's a good point. Probably actually a good thing you can do with all kinds of figures, because I think stats really depend on their definitions as well.
Yeah.
So every time you look at a low crime figure or a high prosecution rate, it's probably all rubbish. there's usually a story behind the figures.
That's brilliant. So what we're asking people to do when it comes to issues like the unemployment figures and others is actually employ critical thinking, is actually just not to take these numbers as a given, not to take them as read, but to actually think about how they were produced, how are they defined, and seek out new media sources and exist, you know, traditional media sources who are doing the same thing. Thanks, Sophia. So, Ed, how can people get involved in terms of challenging, you know, the smear campaign and also, you know, really casting a light on this stuff around the U-turns and everything else?
I would also say basically about supporting media that actually does hold the powerful to account rather than protecting them, because all of this is to do with a useless establishment corporate media which protects the powerful and doesn't hold them to account and just echoes whatever the Tory line is. So basically support the independent new media so that we can continue to challenge the rubbish that the corporate media puts out.
Absolutely. You know, and if any of you are listening and you want to support the Canary somehow and contribute to the stuff that we're doing on the website, you can go to our membership section, which is www.thecanary.co/membership. And there you'll find loads of different ways that you can contribute to the work that we do here and become a canary yourself. I think I'll wrap it up there, guys. Thank you, Bex, Sophia and Ed, for your contributions today. They've been fantastic. I hope you guys at home have had a great listen. And as we say, go to the Canary website and you can read about all of these stories and more that we've covered in the last 7 days. So that's us done for another week at Canary Pod. Please make sure you follow us at Canary Pod on Twitter and use the hashtag Canary Pod to carry on the discussion. We'll see you next week. Until then, remember, don't get angry, get involved.